Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode featuring Dr. Naomi Kahn-Zentner. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Sam, for having me. I'm a fan of this podcast and I've been waiting to be invited for a very long time. So I'm very honored to be here. My name is Naomi Kahn-Zentner. I'm a historical ethnomusicologist. I specialize in Jewish music in Israel, and I'm currently a lecturer on the faculty of the music department at Bar-Ilan University. And I study diasporic and also new religious musical traditions in Israel. Particularly, I'm interested in the Ashkenazi-Sephardi cross-fertilization in shared Jewish-Arab, Ottoman-era musical traditions in Israel. And lately, I'm interested in the music which is used in new religious practices by religious Jewish Israeli women.
Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sounds or music and why this was such a formative experience for you? In particular, what kinds of personal or musical experiences motivated you to want to study Jewish music?
So I grew up in an Ashkenazi synagogue. My father is a shliach tzibur, a prayer leader, and my grandfather was a soloist in a choir in Vienna before the Holocaust in the Klukigasse synagogue. So synagogue music has been part of my upbringing, and the sound of my childhood was hearing my father humming high holiday tunes all around the house, all through summer, you know, in the shower. This is like the soundtrack of my childhood.
Adonai, Adonai, Eil Rachum V'chanun, Elohei Yisrael.
So I was always thinking, even as a child, where is this music coming from? And I knew from an early age that as a girl, I had no chance of ever joining or becoming part of this tradition, but I could study it. And I know I'm not the only daughter of a cantor who chose to become a musicologist who deals closely with this kind of music. So this was, in a way, some kind of way for me to be in contact with this music, which I grew up with and love. So if I'm looking for one particular formative experience or moment, so it has to do probably with the fact that our synagogue was a synagogue with many Holocaust survivors, sort of older people. My father was one of the youngest people there. And, you know, Hungarian, German, Polish Holocaust survivors. And one of the people there was musicologist Avigdor Herzog. He was a member of the synagogue. And one of my favorite moments was when he used to come up to my father after he'd finished davening and say to him, "You know what you sang? It's actually a Hungarian folk song." So he had the ability, and this sort of sowed this seed of understanding for me that this music had a story behind it and that some people could magically know where things came from and where everything originated. And so I remember sort of wishing that I could be one of these people who knew where these certain tunes were from, who knew all about the story behind it. And I guess another formative experience for me was the fact that my father read the Torah differently from everyone else. So he had a Western European tradition of cantillation of the parasha and haftarah, and he taught it to my brothers, of course. And that was different from the more mainstream Eastern European cantillation tradition, which was more prevalent in our synagogue and in many synagogues, basically today in most synagogues.
Atishpot, atishpot, et ir hadamim, vehodata, et kol toavoteha, veamarta, ko amar, Adonai Elohim, ir shofechet dam.
So this for me was interesting to think that there are, even within an Ashkenazi synagogue, there are different traditions of doing, different ways of doing the same things. And particularly as a child growing up in Israel, you know, when you're 13, you go to the bar mitzvahs of all of your friends and you visit vastly different synagogues and you hear Persian and Moroccan and Yemenite and Kurdish cantillation traditions and synagogue traditions. And then you realize how rich this world really is. So this, for me, was kind of a way of thinking about this music as something which really is probably the most interesting thing for me. And at the same time, sort of completely disconnected from this music and this context, I also studied the recorder and the flute, and I learned to play all the classical repertoire for flute, and I joined the Jerusalem Youth Orchestra.
Just after I got out of the army, I started learning in the School of Music from the East. I started learning like sort of wind instruments, and I was discovered by Elad Gabay, who later became really a good friend and colleague and an amazing musician. And he was thinking of starting a band, and he needed a ney player. So even though I played the flute, he sent me to study with Albert Elias, who was an incredible ney player. He originally was from Baghdad, and he had been part of the Baghdad Radio Orchestra, and later the Israel Broadcast Authority's Oriental Orchestra. And he was an amazing musician. He made his own neys. And so I studied there a little bit with him. And then we had this band called Kedem, where we made what was then called ethnic music, Arabic music. And we composed our own music. And I, who really had no background in this, sort of created this, I don't know, quasi-Oriental ethnic music fusion, and it was lots and lots of fun. And I remain good friends with Elad Gabay and with Roni Ishran, who both went on to have amazing careers as musicians specializing in Arabic music. And this also had a great impact on me, and definitely on my Bakashot project, which I, you know, continue to study.
And after the army and after a year of studying Torah in like a women's seminary, it was clear to me I wanted to study music in the university. This was to be able to become a music teacher, which I did for a while. And so I studied for my BA in music at Bar Ilan University, where I met my husband in a world music class, which we both took. And this is a class which I now teach in the very same department. So Jewish music was what led me to study music in university. And whenever I found there was anything in class that was related to Jewish religious music, I found myself very interested and attracted to it. And I took every course which was offered about this topic. And after we got married, and we went for 2 years to Shlichut. Shlichut is kind of to teach religious studies at Jewish schools abroad. And we went to Montreal. And while I was there, I studied for my master's in musicology at McGill University in Montreal. And I was very foreign to the Department of Musicology in many different ways. I mean, I was interested in ethnomusicology, and it wasn't taught there. I was interested in Jewish music, which wasn't really anything there for it. I wasn't Canadian. I was married. I was pregnant for most of it. But I learned a lot, and I felt very welcome. And I wrote my thesis about the Sephardi melodies, which were adopted into the Ashkenazi Orthodox liturgy, sort of the late 19th, early 20th century in London. So I found myself very quickly interested in part of like the whole Jewish music aspect for me. This was what interests me, these kind of melodic differences, things coming across, adoption for tunes, and what significance and sort of secret codes certain melodies had within different cultural contexts, which is something which I later developed in other ways as well. So that's just sort of the beginning of how this all came to be.
Beautiful. That was so eloquently put. Can you tell me a little bit more about your trajectory? So you finish your master's degree at McGill, and what do you do next?
After my master's thesis, which was about sort of these Sephardi Ashkenazi encounters, I was thinking of looking at the domestic sphere at home from a comparative perspective to talk about how Ashkenazi versus Sephardi domestic traditions could be compared. But later I found out that even just focusing on the Ashkenazi families was enough. And so I found myself thinking about the Zmirot repertoire, the Zmirot tradition, the singing at home around the Sabbath table. And this became the topic of my dissertation, which I did at Hebrew University under the supervision of Professor Edwin Sarusi. And I wanted to talk about Zmirot in Israel, That was what interested me. What happens to these musical traditions from the Ashkenazi diasporic traditions when they come in contact with this new nation state and all of its aesthetics of what a song should sound like, what Israeli music should sound like. But I found myself at first beginning to just understand what zmirot are and what, if anything, characterized them musically in the Ashkenazi world. And this took a very long time just to figure out what the world of Ashkenazi zmirot were before I even could get to what happened to them when they come to Israel. And I found myself very surprised at just how communal and family aspects were really crucial for building this sort of domestic, self-curated individual repertoire, which was very deeply connected to belonging to a collective. So this self-perception of a person of what should I sing if I want to belong to a certain social group, you know, which taste group one wants to belong to, which group of peers one wants to belong to. And this was very interesting. It took a very long time because I had another two children during my dissertation, in addition to the other two, which were born before. And so I had like 7 years of writing a dissertation. And then within these 7 years, every Shabbat was kind of a Shabbat of field work because I'm writing about my tradition, I'm among my community, and they're singing all the time, every Shabbat for 7 years. So I have a lot of opportunity to have this sort of undercover, oh, really, what's that tune you're singing? Without ever letting on, you know, sometimes, of course, but this was kind of a way of me to sort of get an inroads of what was happening. And eventually, when I later presented my work in public lectures in front of lectures of audiences who recognized themselves, or I gave it lectures to my synagogue or to our community, I was very proud to sometimes be told, oh yeah, that's exactly what's happening, sort of to get an affirmation of the things which I thought was going on, you know, if it's in a family perspective, in a communal perspective, in a musical perspective, and to hear them sort of be explained to themselves and to hear from them that that rang true, that they said, oh yes, there's something there. And that was a good feeling that sort of the way the research went sort of helped to explain process and dynamics and institutions and the way that music is used to sort of construct a sense of self and a sense of collective and to have a family found soundtrack and to find what really defines us as a family, which is on one hand part of a long lineage of wherever it is we're coming from, but also belonging to religious Zionist or Hasids or something which has to do with our current Israeli sort of placing. All the people who came from the same yeshiva have all these songs from yeshiva. And so you sort of identify your peers according to the songs that they sing. Or you think that you sing what everyone else sings. Of course, this is happening on Shabbat. There's no way to actually check what it is everyone's singing. But your perception is that you're part of this huge imagined community of people who are all singing these same kind of songs, which are domestic songs. They're not happening in a larger sphere, but they're a way of sort of imagining yourself belonging to a larger people. So I guess it's talking about like the codes of what's singing a certain melody, what's the significance that has on a communal level. So that was kind of where my dissertation was.
Der Reue je kol meine maus wein zum kem ke moi maus nim shim kem elo yu vas shu ve nu khu ve yoin shabo der loin shnavi ve ulami ve hoyes ye sha seimi metan soleik mesoy karbi Shei Shabbat b'nei
And later, kind of by chance, I got interested in the music of Safed during the Ottoman era. I'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. And interested in the concept of pop emuni, of religious-based pop, Israeli pop. Lately, I'm thinking about religious women and their new spiritual music making. And I wrote a fun article about the blended Ashkenazi-Sephardi synagogues in Israel, particularly in Jerusalem, in the last 10 years, from a historic perspective of blending Ashkenazi and Sephardi music in the synagogue. So that was lots of fun. And lastly, I'm interested in the concept of reenactment of religious ritual on stage, which is something you may be familiar with because I spoke about it and it was part of my fellowship at the Katz Center, which we shared our fellowship there. So that has been my trajectory. That's where I am right now.
Wonderful. Thinking back on your time in graduate school and all of these different environments you encountered, you were at McGill, where you described the fact of there not being a supportive faculty or student population that was working on Jewish music subject matter. And this, in some respect, is probably a huge contrast to the work that you were doing in Israel, where you were surrounded by experts in this subfield. What kind of advice would you offer to prospective students or new scholars who are planning to enter this field of study and considering possible places they might want to pursue their education?
That's a good question. On one hand, I think one has to really follow their heart, particularly when we speak of people who grew up, let's say, in a Jewish or Israeli environment where we're exposed all the time to so many different things. So it's a matter of following a sense of interest. On the other hand, I think that there's so much of an education that you need to be able to talk and think about these things, to know what has been done. That itself is a challenge because things are not written in one place, and you have to really search and find the key people who you want to ask to mentor you. You have to find your sources, you have to find where it is that you're trying to go with this. So I guess just to go with your heart and to also find the right people who can lead you there, and just to read a lot and to listen a lot, just to enjoy this kind of music. It has to be a labor of love, otherwise nobody would put themselves through this for fun.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And speaking of people who guide you on your path, who have been some of your biggest mentors or role models or advocates along your journey?
So the most natural first one I have to mention is Professor Edwin Sarusi. He was my advisor, I mean, officially on my PhD and on my postdoc at Hebrew University, but unofficially he was even part of me thinking about this kind of music even for my master's. And until today, I really see him as a mentor. He's the greatest scholar in this field, and I'm very, very fortunate to have been able to work with him also in the Jewish Music Research Center. It's been a highlight of my work. Also, I really consider my mentor and Rebbe, Cantor Professor Eliyahu Schleifer, who really is sort of father figure for many of us in the field. We have a WhatsApp group. Don't tell anyone. This isn't going to be broadcast publicly, is it? We have a WhatsApp group, which is called the Students of Maran. Maran is the way Rabbi Ovadia Yosef and all the Sephardi rabbis are called, and it's all the students of Eliyahu Schleifer. Because you really, and I see it. We had a big event last week of cantors who came to honor Eli Schleifer for putting out a book of his compositions. And, you know, there's just a whole group of us who are just Eli followers, the breadth of knowledge and the sort of warm and inviting sharing of this knowledge. So definitely Eliyahu Schleifer. In many ways, also Yudit Frigishi, who was in Bar-Ilan before I joined, but I studied from her as a student, and even now I very much admire her, and she's been very generous with meeting and guiding me. Professor Ruta Cohen Finchoville. She's an incredible scholar and also someone who's been very, very generous in sharing and guiding, and very good and a wonderful advisor, unofficial advisor of good advice. And also my friends who have become colleagues, and in many ways I look up to them, Dr. Amalia Kedem, my good friends, Oded Erez and Abigail Wood, who we worked together on the last article which just came out, and we were together in a research group. So these are people who I learn from very, very much. For me, they are my mentors. Also Matan Vigoda, a good friend and a very amazing scholar of the Hasidic Nigun. So these are people who I really very much look up to.
Let's circle back now to your most recently completed research project. You mentioned your work on Jewish women, but you also had suggested that you might like to share a little bit about your Safed work.
Yes, so my Safed work is the Abulafia project. It's about Rabbi Margolis Abulafia and his snapshot of Safed. So these are very unique self-recorded repertoire from a time and place about which we know very little in terms of music repertoire. And the music was recorded in the 1950s, but it actually reflects the soundscape of Safed up to 1900. And these melodies, which were recorded in New York in the 50s, they're very unusual, and they transcend this discursive binaries with which we talk about music from Palestine. And music from Palestine is often examined in the sort of Arab Jewish Ashkenazi Sephardi new Zionist immigrant old Yeshuv split. But I think that this self-recorded repertoire of a Jew who was born in Palestine is music testifies to a very strong interconnectivity of musical communities in late Ottoman era Palestine. So I found this repertoire of about 100 recordings, which haven't been published, they're still kept by his family. I found this to be a really fascinating research, a snapshot of Safed before 1900. And these kind of musical collections, like memoirs, they can serve as microhistories, particularly within the very complex geopolitical circumstances which are present in late Ottoman Palestine. So the Abulafia recordings, which I wrote about an article which has just been accepted to ethnomusicology, so I'm very happy that it's finally coming out after a very long time. They talk about how a Yiddish-speaking Jew from a Hasidic family whose liturgy is part of these recordings, his liturgy is recorded in one of these 100 songs which were recorded in the 1950s, but some of them are Arabic songs. Some of them are songs in Arabic, and some of them are songs which whose melodies come from Syrian traditions of Arab folk song, whatever folk song means. And it's sort of, in a way, as a testament of the largely undocumented interfaith and inter-ethnic musical exchange which occurred in Safed, which was a city which had Arab and Jewish, Muslim and Jewish, and also Ashkenazi and Sephardi populations living very, very closely together. And it was enough to open the window to hear Arab music coming in, and the vernacular was Arabic, and everything which was taught in school was in Arabic. And so Rabbi Abulafia's grandson says when his grandparents in New York didn't want him to understand what they were saying, they spoke in Arabic, because Yiddish was what everyone was speaking. So Arabic was kind of the Palestinian Jewish language. And as far as music, this was also a music which was apparent to Ashkenazim and to Sephardim. And when they sang Zmirot, the same way as in Germany, the German Jews sang German sounding tunes for Zmirot. But in Palestine, the Ashkenazi Jews sang Arabic sounding Zmirot. For me, this was a very interesting way to talk about him also as a very fascinating individual who was quite different from people around him. He came from a mixed Ashkenazi Sephardi background. He had family from which was from Turkey and also family from Lithuania. His name was Rabbi Margulis Abulafia. So Margulis is the Ashkenazi pronunciation of Margaliot, Margulis. And Abulafia, of course, is the name, a family name of the Turkish Jews coming. His family came from Turkey originally, you know, 400 years before. And so the fact that he had this mixed repertoire that he sings Echad Mi Yodea in Arabic, Wahad Manadri.
Wahad Anadri, Wahad Menadri, Wahadi Li Khalina. Allahu, Allahu, La ilaha illa Allahu. Tnen Menadri, Tnen Anadri, Tnen Musa Beyarun, Wahadi Li Khalina. Allahu, Allahu, la ilaha illa Allahu.
That he has in his repertoire things which he sings for Lag BaOmer, which are in Arabic or Arabic sounding, or sings the songs of the Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews, which are part of his repertoire, for me was really fascinating. And it was an interesting way for me to think of the ethnography of the individual, because often in ethnomusicology, we think about ethnos, you know, we're talking about the music of a group, of a family, coming from a certain locality, of a community. And here we're talking about one individual. And I think that we're, ethnomusicology has sort of graduated into looking into the ethnography of the individual, not just as a unique musician, but also as tradition bearers, and understanding that these things come from various different places and there are different levels within an individual, and he's not just one or another tradition. He's sometimes can be a mix and intermingling of many of them. So I think Rabbi Abulafia, to me, you know, just hearing his voice, carrying with him sort of these sounds which were heard in Safed and may have even been quite popular in Safed, but for now they sound so rare. It's an interesting question of, was it really so strange for an Ashkenazi Hasidic Jew to sing and be so fluent in Arabic? Or was this something quite prevalent, which we just have very little existing documentation of? So this is the question, is he a rare individual, or is this something that we just don't have much ethnography about? So that's something which I really enjoyed writing this project about, and I'm very glad it's out. And it has also led me to thinking about Ashkenazi adoption of Arabic tunes and how instrumental music became vocal traditions, which is something I'm hoping to explore further in the future, in future projects.
I'm really just curious, how did you come across the Rabbi Abulafia recordings? Where were they being kept?
So the intent of Rabbi Abulafia, who actually funded for them to be recording, he found someone who had a recording machine and he opened a studio in his own synagogue and he said, now you sit and record me. And for 2 years, this is what this person did. For Rabbi Abulafia, this was crucial, that this music be preserved. But I think he realized that as a Galilean Jew in New York, he was special. He didn't know what happened in Safed after he left, if things completely changed, which they did. He left in the Ottoman Empire. In the meantime, there was the British Mandate, the State of Israel had started. There were no common shared Arabic-Jewish Meron celebrations anymore, which had been until then. And so he was right in thinking that this needed to be recorded because it was such a unique repertoire. And so he wanted it to be publicized and was pressed into like a 15 LP Smithsonian record set. But all the copies almost were destroyed in kind of a terrible water damage, which where something was flooded. And they really never came out. But there's one record which still exists, and I came across it in the National Library Sound Archives with the help of Matan Vigoda, my good friend, who said, "Hey, listen to this." And I'm like, "What is that?" And then there was a conference, and my friend Oded Erez said, "So are you writing an abstract? Today is the deadline." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, music in the Mediterranean. What am I going to write about?" And then I remembered the Abulafia recordings, and that kind of led to a paper, and that led to this article. So this was the way it came about. But it really is only thanks. It's a private recordings. They're not publicized, and it's thanks to permission I obtained from the family to be able to talk about these recordings and to have them accessible to the public to a certain extent. They're not publicly published yet.
So in some respect, this was a project of last minute necessity.
I think things often happen this way, and you need something, you've had a thought, you don't know if this is going to come to fruition as an article or as a paper. And then sometimes you just have to give in an abstract or a proposal, and you're like, what is it that I can use? And these things sometimes lead to the best ideas because someone needs you. I think as an academic, we're like, we could sit in our little libraries in the quiet and nobody really needs us to do anything. But as soon as someone has like a special issue or a conference about something, or could you just please give a lecture in the National Library about so and so, you find yourself delving in and having an audience, I think, is so important to feel like there's a need and there's an interest in all of this knowledge that you have. And you never really know if it's useful knowledge or just unuseful knowledge. And then when you can actually make use of it and you come to some kind of coherence, and especially I think when you pass it on in a lecture or in an article, there's really a good feeling of, oh yeah, there's substance here which can be useful and interesting. And I think that we want to feel needed
Yeah.
anyway.
You are actually my first guest who has described themselves as a historical ethnomusicologist. And I'm wondering if you might talk me through some of the methodological models or tools that you find yourself most often using across all of your work. I'd also love to hear how you developed your appreciation for them.
So I love working in the archive. I found myself living in room 101 in the old National Library where all the music collections were kept for many, many years. When the recordings of the National Library were digitized and suddenly there were 300,000 hours of recorded sound, which you didn't have to actually go and ask the librarian to pick up and schlep these huge round things, which was always such a pain. And suddenly you could just click on a click and it said click to listen. And I found myself for about a year after my PhD was finished, just sitting and listening to this wealth of musical traditions, which we're recording in the sound archives of the National Library. So that is something I love to do. Also, I like to do field work, and it's always an unexpected, unsuspecting people that you never know when it's going to be interesting. So family, friends, so people I interviewed a lot for my dissertation, community members, musician friends, the lady in the mikveh became an informant, someone singing in the street. Someone singing in some kind of family occasion who I like, yep, that's interesting. That's Hungarian. Let's go follow that. Or a chassid who came to bless the flowers in the sun. So I went up and then had a whole session of recording the chassids of the Erloi Chassidim, thanks to that. So you never really know where this is going to come. I really enjoyed doing this ethnography of interviewing people. I also like to discover older recordings in the library. And lately, my ethnography involves going to lots and lots of concerts of Israeli music. So I think you have to choose your field work and find things you really enjoy doing. For my master's, I was researching London. So, you have no choice but just to go to lovely London and do your field work. So sometimes you just have to choose what it is you enjoy and then find what kind of field work you can do around there. And lately, I'm also sort of more of a popular music scholar, and that involves you talking to musicians and singers and listening about the way these religious women singers, how the perspective of how they're using their voice and what's the ways that they see their concerts and, sort of this blurred line between a prayer and a concert and where they see themselves as far as what their audience are expecting them to be. almost like the spiritual leadership as a woman singer of religious music. So going to concerts, that's one of my favorite fieldwork methodologies.
I love that. I love how you've been able to put together all of the experiences you most enjoy, and then you can call that your work or your research.
There you go. Listen, we're privileged. We know we're very privileged to work in things. First, you can just pursue your interest. That itself is a privilege, I think, that so many people don't have. Also, you really get to choose the people you want to work with, the people you want to interview, which way you want to go, who you want to collaborate with. I think this choice is really probably the most privileged that we have, you know, dealing in our field of music or of research.
Many scholars will celebrate the opportunity to teach others as an extension of their research pursuits. Can you tell me a little bit about your recent teaching or lecturing experiences and how you feel like they've contributed to your research agenda?
At the invitation of Professor Eliyahu Schleifer, who I mentioned before, I was invited to teach at the cantorial program of the Hebrew Union College Jerusalem campus. So I was teaching cantors for about 17 years, a course on Israeli folk and pop music. And I think that this time led me to a deeper understanding of what it is about this music, which was so potent and useful for American cantors. And it gave me a new perspective on the liturgical power of Hebrew folk songs. And it even led me to eventually write for my Hebrew Union College students an article about biblical topics in Israeli pop songs, which I felt I was missing as a teacher. I just wanted to be able to give them a good article in English about how Tanakh, biblical figures and events were portrayed in Israeli pop songs. And I didn't have that, so I had to write it, which often is the case. You know, they need you, it's a necessity. And so I wrote this article, which I enjoy very much. So I taught Israeli popular music, which really wasn't my field. I was a Jewish music scholar, but nobody wants to learn Jewish music. It took a while for me to understand that, but Israeli music, they're very happy to study. So I taught Israeli popular music in many colleges, different colleges in the Open University. And I think teaching always sort of challenges you to learn and to understand more about the topic that you're teaching, and you have to become an expert or at least a scholar in this field. So that's what happened as far as Israeli pop music. And also the lack of courses in Jewish music. I mean, I basically took every Jewish music course which was offered, no matter in which institution. As a student, I went to the Academy of Music. I came to Bar-Ilan, even though I was a Hebrew University student. I took every course I could on Jewish music. And eventually this led me to suggest and to be able to offer an entire master's program in Jewish music, which was at the Schechter Institute of Jewish Studies. So when you have a master's program with 9 courses on Jewish music, you're able to invite all of your friends and to offer a class on liturgical music, which Eli Schleifer was part of and Amalia Kedem taught, or an entire class on the Hasidic Nigun, which Matan Vigoda gave, or an entire class on the music of the Middle Eastern Mediterranean Jews, which was given by Netanel Musay Cohen. And so I was talking about Psalms and Tanakh and in teaching with a Bible lectures, a kind of Bible music integrated course about Shir HaShirim, about the Bible, and also many other courses. So this was really lots of fun to be able to offer so much about the theory of Jewish music, about Israeli popular music, about Jewish themes in Israeli popular music. And I was also very honored to be invited as a guest lecturer to the Yiddish Summer Weimar Summer School. I was there 2 years in a row, and I was invited to teach about music in Israel called The Other Israeli Music. So there I also could share kind of the Abulafia project, the shared Arab-Jewish musical soundscape of Safed in the Ottoman era and about Arabic music in Israel, and even had a chance to teach them about what it is that is Israeli folk music and where it came from. Even though they were looking at the sort of alternative to the mainstream Israeli song, I thought it was very important that people who were dealing with Ashkenazi music and klezmer and Yiddish understand that a lot of the early songs of the Land of Israel and Shirat Yisrael and folk songs, these were all have a very deep level of basic Ashkenazi music, which is built upon, you know, with a new national context.
Sobi, 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 mantera. Ron killu ahabat zinnor, zinnorot horke aleg, zedar kosher hamizmor, min haperez lareg, v'yalu memet eom, mash eva omeret lehem negev, negev mam yom, negev mam terot alecha, sovi, sovi.
So this was fun for me. So I really always enjoyed teaching. This is really a joy for me. And now in Bar-Ilan, I'm continuing in some of these topics.
What an excellent answer. And I particularly am glad that you drew our attention to the fact that sometimes when you don't have the resources you need in the classroom, you just have to write them. And that is as important and compelling a reason to do research as stumbling across an incredible archive or finding the right person to speak to. What kinds of new research questions or subjects would you say are currently preoccupying you?
So lately, I'm interested in what I'm calling the sonic economy of religious music in Israeli mainstream. So I'm asking, for example, what is the significance of the sound of slichot when they're performed for soldiers before they go into battle in Gaza? Like, what is the meaning of having a traditional sound of religious music within the Israeli mainstream? I'm talking about how there are quotes of prayers in Israeli pop songs more and more lately, and there are blessings and prayers which are framing Israeli singers as kind of spiritual leadership, which they turn their pop concert into a ritual sphere, and all of the ways they do that. So an article which I wrote with Dr. Abigail Wood from Haifa University on Slichot is also one of these ways of expressing this interest. So it's called Resonating Repentance, Slichot, and the Performance of Mizrahi Identity in the Israeli Public Sphere. And it talks about how Slichot segued from being only sung in synagogue as kind of, you know, middle of the night, a rite which relatively few people were joining in the Sephardi sphere. I mean, it was happening and there was a lot of following, but at some stage, at the same time of it continuing as a liturgical practice, it also veered into kind of the public sphere, became public pop music and was part of like musicals like Bustan Sfaradi in the 70s, and then became something which is performed in the municipality stage and these huge concerts in the Knesset or in the Sultan's pool, all these big concert venues. So Slichot kind of turning into popular culture and people expecting to have almost kind of a musical peak experience for sure, but even a religious or spiritual peak experience, not in a synagogue, but in a concert setting. And this kind of new role, which is given to musicians, not just to be, I don't know, fashion icons and social media persona, but now they also have to be kind of a spiritual leader. They have to bless the people who come, all the concert goers. They have to show that they're, say, Shema Yisrael before they go up on stage and frame the entire concert as something which is part of a mitzvah, a commandment that they're fulfilling their religious obligation, and concerts which are full of religious music. So I'm very interested in that and where that's going. Also, as you mentioned, kind of music which is used in new religious practices among religious Jewish Israeli women. So Abigail and I have an ISF, an Israel Science Foundation study group of women-only events. And we're interested in how this is very Orthodox women who, you know, we always think of Orthodox as sort of conservative with a small c and interested in preserving what is there. But they're inventing these spontaneous prayers and these new rites and new performative events which never existed before. You know, הקפות שניות for women, סליחות for women, קינות, אוכילה, lots of סליחות, only for women, or הפרשת חלה, where the חלה baking, and they become a huge event of taking out part of the חלה and giving it a special blessing. It's, and all of these things have like fascinating musical performance and expression. So the music is a very deep part of all of these new religious rites for women only. And I find this sort of very interesting coming from the Orthodox world, which is at one time sort of conservative, but at the same time, very creative and border breaking and inventing new things and thinking of women's voices in a new way, particularly within what the Orthodox world thinks of women's voices and as a way to express their individuality and their religiousness and empowering women. And this is kind of a new way. I mean, there's even kind of a new acceptance of this kind of view by women, by men who are encouraging women to use their voice, albeit in women-only context, but still as seeing this as kind of a way of expressing religiosity. And so that I find very interesting. And this is part of a group where we have women research students from all different spectrum of the, you know, religious spectrum, different contexts. They're each coming from a different background and giving us very interesting insights. We have sort of a Lithuanian Haredi woman, mother of eight, who has her insights into the ultra-Orthodox world of what women are doing. We have girls who have grown up in the Ulpan and have a background of kind of the women-only high school experience. And we have all different kinds of sort of perspectives, which I think is leading us to come to interesting conclusions and talking about also the way women have listening practices, what women listen to when they're at home. Do they listen to the same thing in their earphones and in the public sphere? What will they let their children listen to? What do they listen to? Which they don't let their children listen to? That's one interesting thing we're thinking about. Women as musicians and as singers. There's a whole new world of women who are amazing performers and they're singers and they teach singing and they teach vocal classes. And also the role of singing in women-only seminaries for religious studies. Like, what is the importance of singing together, of the Shabbat singing, of the everyday singing, of listening to music in your room while you're cleaning the floor? What kind of music will you listen to? And how religious is it, or versus how much does it, would you sing other Israeli songs which aren't necessarily religious, even though you're in a religious context. So these are interests that we're looking at very recently, and it's a very exciting project. I'm very happy to be able to collaborate with Abby, Dr. Abigail Wood, who's really a close friend and a scholar that I really admire. So it's an honor for me to be able to be part of this work together with her and all these very talented women who are part of our research group.
How would you say that you understand the field of Jewish music? What issues or challenges with this field of study do you think that scholars today should remain attentive to?
So I really like how there are so many different scholars from so many different perspectives and fields, and they all find themselves at the same conferences. And they often look at the same things, but think of them in such different terms. There's like almost no common terminology sometimes. As students, Amalia and I, we would look at five scholars who are all dealing with Ashkenazi music. Like, this is their focus. And each one sees it as a totally different thing. And from such different, almost like different perspectives, and they can almost not have a conversation with each other. That's how far away they are from each other. So in many ways, I feel like Jewish music isn't really a field. I remember a debate which we used to have when we were organizing the musicology sessions of the World Congress of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, which happens once every 4 years. And there was often a debate about whether the Jewish music sessions should or shouldn't be integrated into, you know, the other history or sociology or literary arts of the field, or they should be separate, like have their own 4-day sessions of only Jewish music. So, you know, there's always a question, are scholars of Ladino music, should they be sort of presenting and seeing themselves as part of the field of the context of the Ottoman Empire, of Jewish history and Jewish life? Should Israeli music be studied as part of Israel studies? So, you know, I often find myself as the only music person in a conference about prayer, or about research groups of place and displacement, such as my postdoc program and the culture of place in modern Jewish history, et cetera. On the other hand, in musicology and conferences in the ICTM, International Council of Traditional Music, and in Mediterranean music, you're often one of only very few scholars of Jewish music. So, I mean, this is why the Katz Center Fellowship on Music and Sound and the Jewish Experience was so refreshing, because it was just delightful. You had a group of people. You didn't have to explain to them who Idelson was, on one hand, and you also didn't have to explain what a Sidul was. And it was delightful. So in a way, I think that it's interesting to think of this question that you're asking about the field of Jewish music, because in a way, there's no field. On the other hand, when we do come together, it's like all the bumblebees in the song of No Rain by Blind Melon, and particularly the clip of all these lovely little bumblebees who are all alone, and then they suddenly find each other and come together. So for me, this is kind of the example of Jewish music scholars sort of suddenly finding someone else who's interested in this kind of strange, bizarre field.
I'm so glad that you shared that perspective. Last question.
Yes.
Do you believe that there is such a thing as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound? Why or why not? If so, how would you characterize it? And if this question seems too essentializing, what questions about the music and sound of Jewish experience would you ask instead?
So I have to say that I find it very challenging to try and define and answer any of these questions, and just I find it terrifying actually to try and stand behind one definitive definition recorded for eternity. This is terrifying for me, and I'm living in a terrifying time and a terrifying place, but this was what was terrifying for me. I mean, this reluctance, I think, is actually a good way to talk about this definition of Jewish music, because I don't want anything to be recorded for eternity, because I think what is Jewish in music or what is Jewish music is constantly changing in the way it's perceived by different Jewish groups, and it's very much based on context and on biased listening, and it changes all the time. It's something which is eternally in shift. I was thinking of a tune which was performed by the Ottoman military band in Jerusalem in the 1800s. And it was picked up by Yemenite Jews in Jerusalem and sung by them. And then it was picked up by Ashkenazi Jews who perceived this tune as kind of a traditional Yemenite tune, whereas the Yemenites knew it was a Turkish military band tune. And this is until today. Yeah, Ashkenazi people would sing this as a Jewish Yemenite tune. This is a classic example of this constant moving of music and people, which complicate this notion of what is Jewish, what is Yemenite, what is Ashkenazi music. So it's always a challenge. I mean, besides that, it's all, I think, always a challenge to learn anything from the Jewish case, or particularly the Israeli case. I mean, when you grow up in Israel, how do we define peoplehood? How do I define folk song? How do I define collective identity, or the word, the vernacular? When you grow up surrounded by only Jews or only Israelis, this is in itself an abnormality. You cannot learn about folk song in Israel. You cannot learn about the vernacular in Israel. So we need Hungarians for that, or German speakers, or something to do with like a proper nation to help us understand any of these concepts. So the music of the Jewish experience is just too complex. It's too intermingled and multi-layered to be able to use to define such a thing or such things. But having said that, the Talmudic saying goes, "Patur bli klum I efshar." So exemption without doing anything is not a possibility. You still have to say something. So if one must say something about a definition of Jewish music, after listening to your podcast and hearing all these different definitions of different genius, clever, wonderful Jewish music scholars, The one I identified with most was Kay Kaufman Chalamet, and I very much identify with her need to talk about Jewish music in the context of community, in the context of a particular community, or about the localness of music in the Jewish experience, or the need to be within a community to make it to be meaningful. So one has to be part of a Jewish experience and to have Jewish associations with something for one to recognize a sound as being particularly Jewish. And I hope I'm correctly depicting what it is her definition is. So for me personally, the most Jewish of music is melodic mumbling, if one can even call that Jewish music. I mean, the liturgical Nusach formulas, which they're manifested in every individual's rendition and interpretation of the Nusach, but it also comes to sort of construct this larger communal modal cloud, to use Elie Schleifel's term of the modal cloud, the semi-improvised, very individual, variative mumble within a tradition. It's not usually recorded, it's not usually notated, it's not brought to stage or arranged for musical instrument or given accompaniment. To me, this is Jewish music. So this, I have no doubt, that is Jewish music for me. And I think Yudit Fergishi wrote about the meaning and the experience of Nusach for those who sing it within the Ashkenazi Eastern European synagogue. She wrote about it so beautifully in her book, Writing on Water. And I think it also has to do very closely to my upbringing in a synagogue of Holocaust survivors and to my associations with this sound. So this also further strengthens this case definition, the fact that this is for me within the context of growing up and, you know, what being Jewish is, what being religious is, what being part of a community is, this musach mumbling. So that for me is Jewish music.
Beautiful. Well, Naomi, thank you so, so much for your time today. I so enjoyed speaking with you and I can't wait to share your episode.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam. And thank you in general for having such a wonderful initiative of Sounding Jewish podcast, which I think is really giving a gift to the world in many ways. And thank you for all your efforts to bring these Jewish sounds or Sounding Jewish to the world. Shkoyach, as they say.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA,
and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Stahl Center for Jewish Studies. Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Joseph Toltz to discuss his ongoing research on Jewish music and migration, the Holocaust, and popular music studies.
Bye for now.